Accession number 29703, Wheel 5.
Come in, I heard the sixth one, and I remember the fellas back in London before I ever started flying ops. The bomber fellas would say, if you hear it, it's got you. And I bet it's got me. And the oil began to leak out, and then the smoke began to leak out. The flame started to come out around the engine and started to come in the cockpit. I rolled over at 4,000 feet, dropped out, tumbled. It was a wonderful feeling. I kept thinking I'm supposed to wait until I see the ground come up. Then I happened to think this all happened within maybe a microsecond. I happened to think, well, my intelligence officer has never jumped out. How in the hell does he know you can see the ground coming up? Pulled the ripcord about 2,000 feet. Almost immediately after I pulled the ripcord, I heard the plane scream. I saw it hit the ground, a big explosion. Then I heard people yelling. I heard the doors slamming shut. I heard the dogs barking, and I floated down into a farmyard. And I was shaving twice a week. I was just 20. And I hear I was one of those horrible terror fleeters. And the Germans couldn't imagine. I know these German civilians could not imagine I was a terror fleeter. And they wouldn't let us carry 45s at that time because we weren't strafing yet. If I'd had a 45 and fired it once, they still would have been running. But they stayed away from me. They were scared to death. And I won't go through all the details, but I began to run after about 10 minutes of talking to them, realizing that they weren't going to help me because I thought I was in France. Two fellows ran up and yelled, "Me Frenchman." So I figured I was in France, 200 miles off course. A fighter pilot never knew where he was. I ran up over a hill. A guy grabbed me. Then a German officer saw all the commotion, stopped his car, came over and grabbed me and took me into town. Now, the one thing I want to get across to you fellas, we're all a little older than we used to be. Back in those days, when I left these Germans and started running, I leaped fences like a gazelle. I know I set an Olympic record. About 10 years ago, I went back and spent a day with the German people who captured me, and we retraced the route, and this time they lifted the fences up so I could crawl under them.
I think he's being modest. This leads me to wonder if American pilots, or American aircrew rather, received any sort of briefing on what to do if you were taken prisoner, the conduct you should adopt, or was this subject ignored? Perhaps I can ask you, David.
Basically, very little. The only thing that we were told just prior to the day I was shot down, which was the 28th of July, 1943, was that the underground in Holland had just been blasted, and it was not safe to try to do anything in Holland, and therefore stick by yourself. And that's all I had. I had the escape kit, which had some malted milk tablets and some chocolate, and I just started traveling south. But otherwise, very, very little. To stay away from trying to get into the underground in Holland at that time.
But there were no instructions on what to do if you were confronted with German troops. No. They didn't tell you, not to reach for your 45, which you may not have had, or anything like that. It was a subject which was ignored.
Well, it was as far as I was concerned.
And I think that's pretty general, isn't it?
Pretty general.
Well, Roger, can I just make a comment? I think many of us at that time were probably not interested in the briefings that were given, because I think many of us went over with the idea we're going to win the war or we're going to be killed, one or the other. And prisoner of war was farthest from our mind, so that whatever briefings we did get, I don't think that we remembered all of it.
The usual old thing, you think it never happens to me.
That's right.
Well, Dick, I'm going to put this one to you. We hear or we read in books about Gulag Luft, the infamous or otherwise so-called transit camp. Now, I understand that this isn't quite true. There was some other place that you were taken to. And was it pretty general for everyone to go through some sort of interrogation center before being sent to a prison camp?
Yes, I think very definitely it was that everybody went through some sort of interrogation center. I went through a little bit of interrogation down in Italy before I got up to Gulag Luft. But Royal and I just determined this afternoon that Gulag Luft was not the interrogation center. It was Oberursel in Frankfurt. Now, these two places were very close together. Now, Gulag Luft means Durchgangslager, meaning transience camp. And the other one was Oflag. There's an Oflag, which is Offizierslager or officers' camp. Now they didn't always stick with this. I mean, they also had airmen in these officer camps, supposedly. And the third one was Stalagluft, which comes from the word Stammlager, or the original camp, or the first camp. The Stammtisch, of course, is the original table. So there is a difference, but there is a misconception that Dulagluft was the interrogation center. It was not. It was Oberursel.
Well, can you tell us what happened there? Can I put that to you, Francis? What happened to you at the...
At the Dulagluft?
Yes.
Well, at Dulagluft, it was sort of a transient place where they decided whether you're going to be sent to Sagan, Barth, or Stalagluft 3. And it was sort of a transition center. And our center, Dulagluft, was located where I went, was near Wetzlar, Germany. And Wetzlar, Germany at that time was a prime target for the 8th Air Force, the B-24s and the B-17s. As a matter of fact, we had some pretty good shows, about three of them. Three outstanding shows where the B-17s and the B-4s came over and destroyed the industrial complex. And that's why you weren't getting the Leica cameras after the war very early, for the simple reason that the Leica camera works was among the industrial complex that was destroyed there. And they had great marshalling yards at that particular point. So it being the prime targets, we did get to see some real good shows. As the bombers came on over, they came over the camp, and it looked like the bombs. We could see the bombs falling, and it looked like the bombs were going to come directly on the plant. On the camp, and we all ran for our little shelters, that is, underground shelters at the time, but the bombs went on about another 3 miles and hit their primary target, Wetzlar. So from there, we were distributed. I went to Stalagluft 1, others went to other places.
But what actually happened to you at that camp? I mean, did they interrogate you?
No interrogation whatsoever. It was a transient camp. You received your proper clothing. You received your Red Cross, what you call bundled shoes and pants and a jacket and so forth, and a few other incendiary items like toothpaste maybe and a few other little things that would carry over in your trip out to Stalagluft 1. And that was it. And some of the people were probably fumigated, those that, you know, had lice or something like that. But
surely you were interrogated somewhere.
That's Oberursel. That's right out to Frankfurt.
Was that before the transit camp?
That was before Dulagluft, which would be before the transit camp.
So you were taken, as soon as you were captured, to the interrogation camp.
That's right. Oberursel, take you to Frankfurt, you jump a truck or a streetcar, trolley, and you'd go out to, forget the name of the hospital there, Mark's Hospital, and Oberursel was right there.
I see. So there were two distinct camps.
That's right.
Now, John, when you went down, did you go to an interrogation center?
Oh, yes. I, too, went to Dulagluft. And as I remember, my experience in Dulagluft was a little different. I know when I came out of the cooler there, I only walked about 20 yards, and I was in the so-called prison with those who were waiting shipment to other camps. But I was detained in the cooler, the hot and cold box, for about 3 weeks.
Why?
I think it was dependent on how stubborn you were, I guess. And that hot and cold treatment was interesting, and I think most of us went through that. It was deliberate, no question. The tiny little cell in which you found yourself alternately would be extremely warm, and then you'd find yourself very chilled. And next morning, would come the interrogation officer, and always very polite, courteous. I remember the first day I was there, he came in and he very politely laid down this Red Cross form and asked me to fill it out. Matter of fact, that may have been several days later, but the Red Cross form seemed innocuous enough, except that it asked for your organizational name and identification, address, and all those good things that you weren't supposed to tell. Interestingly enough, some of the prisoners that were taken did fill those forms out. I always wondered why they would do that, but they surely did.
Roger,
I might say
I spent a month at Oberst in solitary, the same kind of treatment. In my case, I had been a YB-40 pilot, if any of you guys knew what that was, and which was supposed to be a four-engine escort plane for the bombers back in the spring of 1943, and they were trying to find out what the YB-40 was all about. And quite frankly, I think if I had stayed there very much longer, I probably would have told them anything I knew. But the Americans were getting shot down so fast, they had to move me out to get somebody else in.
So it seems then, David, that you were specially selected because you had special experience, because there weren't many of those YB-40s.
Well,
the interesting thing is, how did they know that you had been in a YB-40?
Well, they knew that the YB-40s were connected with the 92nd Bomb Group, and I was with the 92nd Bomb Group and had the marking on the airplane. Mm-hmm. So that wasn't very difficult. And then what they started, and I was the 327th Squadron, and that was the squadron, and they knew all about it. I think that everybody spent a little time. I think that 3 weeks for John, a month for me, was longer than normal.
So they were obviously selective. What about you, Royal? What was your experience?
There are a couple of things here I think we ought to clarify. Go back to this Interrogation Center West. I don't know the German, I can't pronounce it. The formal name of the Interrogation Center at Oberursa was Interrogation Center West. Apparently there was one on the east somewhere for the Russians. But that was located at Oberursa. Then the transient camp, which is Dulag Luft, and the intelligence officers in England did not know the difference. They kept telling us we would be interrogated at Dulag Luft, and for just until 2 or 3 years ago, I found out the difference from Hans Sharp. The Dulag Luft, when I went, got out of an interrogation and was released, I went to Dulag Luft in a park in the center of Frankfurt, Germany. But in the spring, when they bombed Frankfurt, they hit that camp. And I think some Americans were killed, and they moved the interrogation center to Veldspetsland that time. But I was only there 3 days, and Hans Scharf again told me that it depended on various factors how long a man was kept there. I was a dumb second lieutenant. What does a second lieutenant know? And already he even knew my mother's maiden name, that I'd been in engineering at Ohio State. So he figured I either didn't know much or they weren't going to get much out of me because of lack of knowledge. He said also they figured a fellow did have something that they hadn't gotten out of him yet, they would hold him longer. And there's another point that I've never seen this ever printed anywhere, that Hans told me that they also interrogated fellows who had captured for another purpose, that they almost had a fear that they would try to sneak someone into a prison camp who was not a flyer, but someone who had organized some sort of a mass escape type thing. And they wanted to make certain that all of us were Allied airmen, that we weren't some sort of a plant that was sent in specially to organize a mass escape from a prison camp.
Well, that's most interesting. It's the first time I've ever heard that mentioned. But I think we should tell the audience something about the camps themselves. How big were they generally, and were they divided into compounds? What was the general layout of a prisoner of war camp? Was it on special terrain? It comes to mind that did the Germans place it on land which you couldn't easily make tunnels in and that sort of thing. Now, who shall I put that to?
I think maybe I can best handle that by showing you some pictures that we have that were blown up for the prisoner of war reunions. And if you don't mind, I'll just
No, of course. Go ahead.
If you can hear me, this is Dulag Luft 3, can you all see? And I imagine that Barth was very much like that.
I imagine that Dulag 1 was very much like this. This was the North Camp, which was British. This was the South Camp, which was American. The West Camp, which was American. These were separated. This was the center camp, which was American, and the east camp, which was British. This entire area here was German barracks, German soldiers. I can't tell you how many there were, but it was a sizable contingent. Out in this area here was what they call the forelager. That's where the parcels came in. That's where everything, the mail was distributed, and that's where a lot of the necessary smuggling and other stuff took place in order to get escape material into camp. Then this is a view of Dulag 3 and it shows how barren it was with the guard towers, as you can see here. The double row of barbed wire, the warning fence, which was just about a foot high, and you were not allowed to cross over it. The barracks, and this was all sandy soil, so it was very, very difficult to do any digging. Here's another picture of it. It was very stark. The woods were set quite far back from the fence, which was along here, and you can see the warning towers all around.
Most camps were of a similar pattern as Royal. You were in Stalag Luft 1. Was that as large as Stalag Luft 3?
No. Stalag Luft 3 was in being before Stalag Luft 1 for American airmen came into being. Originally, it was a small British camp, and in late 43, because they were getting so darn many Americans into Osaga, I guess they couldn't build the barracks rapidly enough, they opened up. They changed Stalag Luft 1 over to an American camp, and at that time it consisted only of the South Compound. And I got there about 25 February of 44, and they had just opened up North 1 Compound. And in the next 15 months, they added two more compounds, and Colonel Gabreski was in North 3. I remember the day he walked down the road. We heard that our top ace was coming, and I remember standing watching him walk down the road.
Francis, how many can you recall? How many people were there in a compound in Stalag Luft 1?
Yes, I can remember vividly what we had there. We had a total.
We had a total of about 10,000 people there towards the end of the war as we were starting to evacuate. But the compound was organized along military lines. Just visualize a compound like a group, and then each one of your what you'd call quarters or shacks or barracks was known as a squadron. And we had anywhere from 9, 10, or 11 squadrons to a compound. The reason we had the compound, it was subdivided into South Compound, North 1, North 2, and North 3, was because they didn't want the 10,000 people mingling together. They had you separated by wire fence and barbed wire and what have you. So each compound consisted of about 2,000 to 3,000 people. My compound that I had, which was the last compound that was built there, had about 2,300 people on it, and it was about nine barracks, and there were about 200 people to a barracks at that particular time. The 200 people, again, were divided among anywhere from 10, 11 rooms or so. And as the room was structured, it was structured there in tiers. The tiers were beds. We didn't have individual beds. It was just like a shelf that you slid your way into, and you slept on straw that was pretty well confined in burlap sack to a degree. And there you were, about anywhere from 16 to 18, 19 people in tiers in this one great big room. And in the last compound that was built, we had a kitchen so that we didn't have to we weren't forced to do all our cooking within the room. All the Red Cross parcels that came in, all the preparations, your corned beef and all that, and your heating of clam and all that was done within your room. But everything that the Germans provided was done in a central kitchen. It had big vats. Anytime that you'd have a good bombing down a road or you'd kill a few horses and so forth, we'd see the remnants of those horses coming into the camp, and they would be cut up, and we'd put them in these big vats, boil them and so forth, and it did make real good, delicious stew. Every now and then you had to watch out because some of the shrapnel was still in it, and if you had fragile teeth, well, your teeth wouldn't survive the shrapnel. So it was that type of a thing. And we had a
S1, which was a personnel officer assigned to the compound. We had an intelligence officer or security officer assigned. This was our own organization within that compound. The Germans did not partake in the organization of a compound. They were all on the outskirts. They did their checking every morning, once in the morning, and once in the evening to make sure that everybody was accounted for, to make sure that those were that were out in the hospital were identified and counted, as well as those that were lined up in front of the barracks were counted. So that's about all I can tell you.
Okay, thank you. Now, David did mention the German guards. Royal, can you recall just how strong the guards were around Stalag Luft 1? Did you have many? Were they Luftwaffe personnel or army, or were they German police?
When I first went down, we had Luftwaffe personnel. I don't remember the numbers, but they had a healthy contingent of troops there. The German soldier, the guard, was not excitingly intelligent, but the officers were. They were first class. Some of them had been Luftwaffe pilots. I remember one we had a wooden leg. Wehrmacht, now, Colonel Gabreski, correct me on this, Luftwaffe guard stayed until things got rough in Russia, and I'm thinking it was probably early in 45, and we started getting in some Wehrmacht, if I remember, and the last part of the war, they all became the Volkssturm, the People's Guard, and all the regular soldiers disappeared, and these were old men wearing parts of World War One uniforms. One might have a World War One blouse, one might have a World War One helmet. It was pretty pathetic. That was probably the last month and a half of the war before we were liberated by the Russians.
Dick, have you got any observations on that, on the strength of the German guard?
Again, Roger, I don't know the exact strength, but we had, as you well could see off of that picture that that Dave was showing there, they had a very large barracks section. Now, we weren't the only ones that they were guarding. There were Russians around, and there were also some other prisoners around that were probably guarded out of this camp. But ours were mainly Luftwaffe people. And Royal, I'm going to have to say that I think some of the, not only the officers, but also the airmen, the enlisted people that were our guards, were pretty bright. I'm thinking of Hohendahl, I'm thinking of Glimnitz, I'm thinking of couple of other people that I thought were pretty smart, and
they were motivated.
Yeah, they were tremendously motivated,
they
and
didn't
of course,
want to go to the East Front.
This was their Stalag Luft 3 was considered by Goering one of his best camps.
We need to know how the camps were organized within. In other words, did military discipline prevail? And who was the top dog? Who was the senior Allied officer, or was there a senior British and a senior American officer? How was this decided? What was discipline like? And in fact, was the whole camp run on strictly military lines? Perhaps, David, you could tell us.
Well, I think John Bennett might do better because he was there from the very beginning of Stalag 3. And John, why don't you do that?
The senior officer system